ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a very personal question, Priya. Do you snore?
I don't. If Will was here, he sometimes says if I'm very, very tired, but I'm not a day-to-day snorer. That's quite a personal question.
It's a very personal question. But, you know, people often confuse snoring with sleep apnea. They think sleep apnea is all about snoring.
Yes, but it can exist without snoring. It can exist in snorers, but it's not all about the noise.
Yeah. I'm a snorer. I'll just confess. So I've got a lie on my side. So I've got this bruise on my back
from
somebody who hits me whenever I snore. But I don't have sleep apnea, as far as I know, anyway. But sleep apnea is one of the things, and diagnosing it and getting the diagnosis wrong because of the technology is one of the things we're going to be talking about on today's Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land,
and I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, when a couple is struggling to conceive, historically women have been the focus of infertility discussions, but new guidelines shift the focus to men.
It's often a combined thing, isn't it?
Both
women and men, and men get
sidelined, not anymore.
Now, getting a joint replacement is a big operation, but how many knee replacements do you think occur each year in Australia, Priya?
I'm going to have a complete guess, 70,000.
Well, pretty good, actually. There's 70,000 hip replacements and 85,000 knee replacements.
You owe me chocolate.
A lot, that's right. It's a lot. But, you know, they don't last forever. How long will they last? And there are some hidden surprises.
If you're a new parent, you might have seen these allergy starter kits advertised, which promise to help you introduce these allergy foods safely. But do they have evidence behind them?
In news this week, well, let's just depart, Priya, from our normal practice, because I wanted to return to a story we did last week, which got a lot of response on peanut allergy and how it was reducing.
Yes.
In following early introduction of solids to children and early introduction of these allergenic foods. And you had an experience this week.
I did.
To share it.
I called you from the clinic, didn't I? Because I saw a patient who had had an allergic reaction to what is now called an allergy starter pack. So introducing some of these common allergy-causing foods, but not in the traditional way. And for once, I can say not like I did it in the old days, because I feel old. So when my kids were small, and they're only 9 and 5, I introduced the egg, the peanut protein, doing mashed up stuff and peanut paste and smooth stuff. Now, a lot of parents and caregivers are using these allergy starter packs, sachets of egg, peanut, the other stuff.
And the question is, do they work? What ones should you buy? And to answer those questions, we've got Professor Mimi Tang, who is a paediatric immunologist and allergist at the Royal Children's Hospital and the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. So Mimi, welcome to the Health Report. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Before we get to these starter packs, let's just talk about the data here. So last week we talked about the American study, which showed significant reductions following the change in food introduction guidelines. And we weren't aware of Australian data at that point, but you've got Australian data on the effects in Australia.
Yes, we do. We've actually looked in two different ways. So we have examined food anaphylaxis admissions across Australia using national admissions data, and that's been showing some very interesting findings. We had guideline changes twice in Australia, one in 2008, where we said no longer avoid, because, you know, historically we were telling everybody to delay the introduction of allergenic solids. And in 2008, ASCIA came out with updated guidance that said, look, there's no evidence to delay, so let's not tell people to do that anymore. So we removed that recommendation. And then in 2016, after two major studies, we updated the guidance further to say actively introduce allergenic solids from around 6 months of age, but if possible, within the first year of life. And we tracked anaphylaxis admissions across Australia over three time periods, before 2008, 2008 to 2016, and then 2016 to initially 2019, but we've recently published out to 2022. And the message is very clear. There is slowing in food anaphylaxis admissions. The absolute number of admissions is still going up, but instead of going up in an exponential trajectory, it's basically flattening. You know, these are early days, but we think the trial setting is obviously very different to the real world setting. And perhaps it's a little bit more confusing for parents for what to do. There may be more reluctance without the strong support of a clinical trial team, and or it might be that it simply isn't as effective in less high-risk patient populations, because generally speaking, the trials that have been completed have been conducted in high-risk populations.
So normally, maybe when people introduce these foods, they were doing it with the actual food itself, so some peanut paste or some egg. Now a lot of people are relying on these starter packs, which they can get either online or at a pharmacy. Are they effective? Is there evidence showing that they're as good as doing it with solid food or better than?
So, I mean, what we do have is very strong evidence that introducing allergenic solids in the first year of life can significantly reduce the risk of developing food allergy. But what's less clear is the exact amount and the frequency that is required for a protective effect to be achieved. So the large trials, LEAP and EAT, that I mentioned earlier, they used an intervention of a fairly high and frequent dosing. So they were suggesting 2 grams of allergen protein. So that's not weight of the food, that's the protein content of the allergen in the food. 2 grams of that, 2 to 3 times a week, depending on the study that you were looking at.
So it's not nothing.
No, it's not nothing at all. And what's interesting, actually, it's about a standard serve. So to give you context, 2 grams of peanut protein is what you'd get in a teaspoon of peanut butter or one of those little sachets. So it's about a standard serve for a baby, right? I mean, you spread that over a piece of toast and the baby nibbles on it. In the case of egg, it's probably about an egg. So when we say 2 grams, 2 to 3 times a week, that's a weekly dose of about 4 to 6 grams of allergenic protein. Now, the EAT study also then did an analysis to see if there was a dose effect, and they did indeed find evidence of that. They found that a dose of around 2 grams a week was actually having a beneficial effect, not to the same degree as 4 grams in their study, but certainly it was having an effect. So that's the first thing. The second is...
So just to capture that, so that's the more the better... 2 grams still had an effect, but if you're doing less than 2 grams, you may not be getting much of an effect at all, presumably.
Correct. That's actually spot on. And then there's another piece to it, which is frequency. And some studies are suggesting that, you know, although LEAP and EAT did 2 to 3 times a week, those that were going 4 to 5 times a week also seemed to be getting a little bit more benefit. So the point about these new products, I think a number of these are coming out because the aim is to make introduction for families easier. My concern is I'm not 100% convinced these products are achieving that goal. So the background for why they wanted to make it easier is in the EAT study, you know, only around a third of patients enrolled in the study or families enrolled in the study actually succeeded in introducing 5 of the 6 foods at amounts that were 3 grams a week instead of 4 grams a week for at least 5 weeks instead of the proposed 8 weeks. So you can already see, right, they've dropped the bar for what protocol was recommending, and yet only a third of those patients were able to achieve that.
And that's in a trial where you're being watched over and cajoled.
Because you're tired and it's hard work and you've got a child. So it's not easy. So the starter packs are there to really make it much more achievable for parents. But the question is, are they getting a high enough dose? Are we actually reducing the risk? Yeah.
Correct. So I mean, that's my take on it. I'm not convinced that they actually make things easier for the families. I mean, the first point is that, as you've said, the doses in the majority of products are much, much lower than that 4 to 6 grams a week that was trialled, or even the 2 grams a week that through post-hoc analyses is shown to be of benefit. There is one product actually that was developed based on the LEAP trial by one of the LEAP investigators. It's peanut puffs basically, and they do have in each packet 2 gram serving. So, and then they do have another product of mixed nuts that has the right dosing as well. But I'll come to that point about mixed foods. It's a separate thing.
That's actually what I was going to ask you. Is it possible, because these are artificial supplementary foods, that they could actually paradoxically have an adverse effect rather than the whole food, which is mixed with all sorts of natural compounds, which could actually affect the immune system in their own right?
Well, that's a very complicated question. The first thing I would say is we know that babies who have a more diverse diet and foods prepared at home during the early years of life have lower rates of food allergy than those who do not. We also know that processed foods are not generally favourable for healthy immune metabolic programming through your life. So on a more general level, one would think pushing in a direction of medicalized supplements really may not be in the right direction. Because what I was going to say was, look, we know it's difficult. What we need to do is to make it easier for families. And whilst the aim of these products is to make it easier, I'm not sure that happens. The reason being, it sort of ends up being, oh, I have to take this supplement, as against just introducing normal foods in standard serves that the family likes to eat and then keeping them in the diet for the baby. The main thing is to introduce one food at a time so you can identify if there is an allergy. That's my advice usually to my patients.
Thank you so much, Mimi. That's been incredibly insightful. Thank you so much for your time.
Professor Mimi Tang, who is at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, a paediatric immunologist and allergist.
Last week, we did a story in the news section about shingles vaccination and a reduced risk of heart disease, and you just wanted to make a correction.
Yeah, this is a kind of mea culpa. We normally declare clearly how reliable the study is and if it's important who the sponsor is, and we didn't do that in this case. So, in fact, this was an abstract at a conference, so not a peer-reviewed paper. And it seems that the vaccine manufacturer, GlaxoSmithKline, was the one who sponsored the research. And we've said many times on the show, when you've got the manufacturer sponsoring research, you tend to get a more positive result, or you're more likely to get a positive result. So we just wanted to say it may well be right. It looked like a reliable study, but we just wanted to put that caveat. We should have done it last week. Now we've done it.